You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
The Athletic.
We talk sprint formats and tyre pressures and answer a bumper crop of your questions on end plate damage, ride height variation over race distances and getting worse to get better, and much more. Welcome to the latest edition of the Race F1 Tech Show. I'm Ed Straw, still here in China after the Grand Prix, but thanks to the wonders of modern technology bridging the 5,000 or 6,000 miles, I'm joined by Gary Anderson. And Gary, of course, has done most technical jobs in F1, design race winning cars, has always had a remarkable knack for breaking down technical complexities in motor racing. So how's things, Gary? F1's return to China bring back any memories for you?
It's obviously... It's nice to see them back in China. There's such a huge crowd there and such a huge support for it that it's a huge market, to be honest, for Formula One. And it's great to see them back after all this, the troubles we've had worldwide, but China have had fairly dramatically. So it's a good circuit. It's a pity to see that sort of thing wasted. I think it does bring out the best in cars. There's a good mix there between high speed, low speed, and a straight line performance. So it was a good weekend, and we did see some good racing.
Yeah, and I think everyone quite enjoyed being back at that track. I think it has something to offer, as you just said, so quite popular. So as always, we'll have a free choice of topic to start the podcast. Anything catch your eye over the weekend?
Well, obviously it was the first sprint race, so with the changes in the regulations for the sprint races this year, it was interesting to see how that unfolded. Everybody will have an opinion on how it should change or what it should be, but at the end of the day, it's a 1/3 Grand Prix distance race with its own qualifying session, and I think it served that purpose. There's not massive amount of points for it, but it was a good race. It was a race that, it was 19 laps of racing for everybody right through the field. Max Verstappen didn't have all his own way to begin with, and it's quite interesting how it's very clever at driving, really. At the beginning of it, you thought, the first three or four laps, you thought, well, he's in a bit of trouble here. He's not barreling past the leaders as quickly as you'd expect him to. But, that's the time whenever the tyres are at a crucial stage. You just got to look after them for those three or four laps. And if you can do that for those three or four laps when the rubber, the level of rubber on the tyres is quite thick, then there's a good chance that you end up having a better tyre later on in the stint. And also, driving around behind somebody, if you're not in a position to really attack them and pass them, you hurt your tyres as well. So it just shows that, mixing at the front and driving away from somebody, he's very good at it. And whenever he has to sort of think twice about it and look after the car and the tyres a little bit, he's also very good at it. So I think it just shows the domination that he personally is having in Formula One at the moment. And it's much deeper than just having the best car, to be honest. He's doing a fantastic job.
I guess the really interesting technical elements when it comes to the sprint format is that Parc Fermé being lifted between the sprint race and qualifying proper, and various teams, well, pretty much every team took advantage of that to some degree. Mercedes caused themselves a few problems with some bigger changes. So how would you approach that? Obviously, there's a limited window, so although you can do all sorts of setup changes, there's not an infinite amount of time to change complicated things. And then, of course, apart from how you enter when qualifying starts, so you're going in blind, you can't test it, you just have to make the big setting changes and then make the best of it. So how would you feel about that?
Well, I think it was really done to save the embarrassment of Austin last year, where both Hamilton and Leclerc got disqualified after the main race because of plank wear. It allows them to actually, the main objective was to actually allow you to sort of tidy up the ride heights, I suppose, due to the wear during the sprint race, because that's the first time you would get a decent run over a decent amount of laps. So I think, as I say, Mercedes shot themselves in the foot by doing whatever they did. I mean, they talk about draconian setup changes and whatever on Hamilton's car, but why? You know, he finished second in the sprint race. He wasn't going to beat Verstappen, but he did a solid job. There was cars behind him that probably expected to finish ahead of him. Why would you do so dramatic a setup change on it? Why wouldn't you just sort of dot the I's and cross the T's and make the best out of the car that you've got? Because if he'd done that, you know, they would have had a much better race. Okay, a mistake in qualifying put him 18th on the grid, and it was always going to be difficult to recover from there. But, you know, for that first stint, when he had the soft tyres on, he didn't go anywhere. It was just, you know, just follow around those guys that were, you know, second slower than him, to be honest. So, or second slower than he should be. So, in reality, it's one of those things where it does give you the opportunity to optimise your car a little bit for the Grand Prix, but it also gives you the opportunity to do exactly what Hamilton did and shoot yourself in the foot. So, you need to be very careful with it. You need to look at where you are and where you expect to be, and then try to do the best you can. I think if we take the Mercedes situation, I think what we saw with Russell at the weekend was getting the best out of the package that he has. And that's where they are. You know, they are, in reality, they are behind Red Bull, obviously. They are behind Ferrari. They are behind McLaren. And they are behind Aston Martin, or at least to nip and tuck with Aston Martin at some points in time. So they just need to accept that right now. Just get the best out of what they've got consistently, and allow the development team to understand the car and where its deficits are, rather than trying to find that magic bullet that will put them in the front of the grid again and allow them to win races, because they haven't got the equipment to do that. It's a good thing, and it made the opportunity for the race a little bit better. But I don't think it's any big thing, and each team needs to respect it in their own personal way.
Yeah, exactly. There were actually a few concerns about the ride height thing. One team boss mentioned on Thursday that F1 would look very stupid if you got a load of cars thrown out at the end of the sprint for plank wear. Obviously, it was unlikely to be that bad, because the short duration of the sprint means even if you have got it a bit wrong, you're probably not going to do quite enough damage. But it does show that there's still uncertainty in teams, isn't there? Even with all the simulation tools they've got, with these ground effects cars, the Venturi cars, there's still that area of uncertainty because of all the effects that you've talked about many times on this podcast.
Yeah, I mean, the performance comes from getting the cars to be low to the ground. That's how a ground effect car works, and how you seal the sides of the floor to act like an invisible skirt, I suppose you might call it, to stop air leaking underneath the car. So it's always going to be the challenge is to maximise the downforce relative to what ride height you're running. But, you know, what you have to do is make sure the car ends up legal. So if the car has to run a millimetre higher and you lose a bit of downforce because of it, then the car needs to run a millimetre higher. You need to find solutions to getting that sealing effect down the sides of the car without having the car mechanically running so low to the ground. So it's a balancing act, to be honest. I mean, if it's the sprint race was 19 laps and you're going to be starting the race there with, you know, 35 kilograms of fuel. So in effect, you shouldn't really have a big problem with plank wear. If you've got a problem with plank wear in the sprint race, you're going to have a massive problem with plank wear in the main race because of the extra fuel, the 105 kilograms or whatever we're going to start with. So it's it doesn't make a big difference, but the extra fuel does. How would you say it slows the car down? It's just heavier. It just doesn't move so easily. So when you do touch the ground with the underfloor, you know, it would stay there longer with heavier fuel. So I don't think the sprint race is going to be a big drama, but you've got to read it right, and you've got to make sure that you realise the differences between that 35 kilograms and 105 kilograms and what that will do to the ride heights and the duration that the ride height will stay lower. So yeah, it's just work. It's just simulation and work and making sure you're on the safe side rather than the risky side.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about, is it something that's not talked about a huge amount with modern Formula One cars? It's the old setup tool of the tyre pressures, but obviously it's not a setup tool because this is something that's stipulated by Pirelli. The tyre pressures, particularly for the front tyres, were really high in Shanghai. They were basically targeting an expected stabilized running pressure of 28 PSI was what they were gunning for, which is very, very high for an F1 car, isn't it? And you're getting into road car territory. So I thought that was worth talking about. Perhaps you can contextualize how high that is, why they might be doing that, and why the lower tyre pressure and the tyre pressure freedom is something that is not allowed to teams anymore.
Yeah, well, I mean, if I go back to the old days, I suppose, of the Bridgestone and, you know, even Goodyear and whatever back in the 90s, we were running at a low-speed track like Monaco. You'd run, you know, maybe 17, 18 PSI front pressure and 14, 15 PSI rear tyre pressure, because the lower the tyre pressure, obviously, the larger the contact patch. So the more rubber on the ground as such. Way back whenever we didn't have blankets, you would be leaving the garage, you know, this is before the 90s. You'd be leaving the garage at, you know, less than 10 PSI front pressure and 5 or 6 PSI rear, because the pressure builds up with the temperature increase. But, you know, you had to look after it at that point in time because the tyres could come off the rims. But as we went through time, the tyre pressures become much more critical. High-speed track, as I say, in the 90s, you'd be running maybe 18 to 20 PSI front and 16 to 18 PSI rear. And you'd use that pressure as a sort of optimization for balance, downforce balance and grip levels. So tractions, obviously, would be better with a lower rear tyre pressure. The car would be a little bit more nervous if you had a lower front pressure in high-speed corners, but better grip in low-speed corners. So it was a balancing tool. But now Pirelli legislate that, you know, the pressure of the tyres. And that's all come from the fact that these cars produce so much downforce. You know, they're producing end of a straight or in a very high-speed corner, they're producing 3.5-4 tonne of downforce. And that all has to go through the tyre. So you end up with a situation where the tyre sidewall takes all that load. But also the fact that these cars, ground effect cars, are running stiffer suspension-wise, because that's one way they can control the ride height. But, you know, the input movement of going over curbs or any input movement in high-speed corners will all still go through the tyre. So if you run the suspension, for example, solid, then all that input will go through the tyre sidewall. If you run the car softer, then some of that input will go through the suspension. So it's a balancing act, and Pirelli, obviously, the last thing they want to do is see tyres fail. And their way of sort of looking at that and trying to control that is to run the higher pressures. As you say, the pressure is very high. It's high for everybody. The big problem with that is low-speed corners, where you don't have the actual aerodynamic forces. You know, that a high tyre pressure will give you less grip. It will hurt the traction. And as we see very often, once you start to spin the wheels off a corner, it just spirals, it just gets worse. And that is all sort of instigated from the tyre pressures being high. But the tyre pressures are high because the teams are running the cars more or less, well, very stiff, or most of the teams are running the cars very stiff. So the tyre sidewall's taking all that that curb input. And it is that those inputs are massive. I mean, we've seen in times where the suspension, we have suspension failures just from going over curbs. So the tyre is just the same. It can only absorb a certain amount, and pressure inside the tyre just stops that happening. So it's one of those situations. It's a spiral to nowhere, I suppose you might call it. But nobody's going to want half the downforce on the cars. If you half the downforce, you would immediately be able to run the tyres softer. But that's not going to happen. So either Pirelli have to come up with a much more rigid tyre, which is where they were heading with the bigger rims and lower profile sidewall. But that didn't really work out because if you take the volume change, it's actually very small. The complete tyre itself got to be a bigger diameter. So the actual input, the volume inside the tyre, even with the bigger rim, is negated by the fact that the tyre is bigger itself. So it didn't really do them any good. So they're stuck on the same boat as they were with the 13-inch rims as such. And as I say, the only thing to do is to build a tyre that's you know, very, very stiff in itself and its construction. And then the pressures could probably be reduced a little bit. But it's very difficult to do that because you know, you've got to be very careful where the coupling of the tread and the sidewall meet. That's the area where it's really going to deflect. And if you have a solid sidewall, it's all going through one little area. So, again, it's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah, it's an everlasting battle for the tyre manufacturer as well. It's a difficult task being in Pirelli's position. They're trying to sort the tyres for next year. They were tyre testing recently at Suzuka, actually, after the Grand Prix, and they're trying to once again get less temperature-sensitive tyres because that's something that everybody wants and actually would cut back on some of the nonsense there is on preparation laps and out laps and that kind of thing in qualifying. But yeah, it seems to be a bit of a losing battle because they've been fighting that one for quite a while. Well, as we've got plenty of listener questions to answer, we thought we'd have two question sections this week, which will allow us hopefully to give some in-depth answers and allow Gary to get his teeth into them. The first one comes from Johnny from Berkshire, which relates to the Chinese Grand Prix, who says, on Sky's commentary, Nico Rosberg exclaimed that when Zhou lost his front wing end plate late in the Chinese Grand Prix, it was going to have a huge impact on performance. He suggested tenths per lap. I thought losing a front wing end plate was much less damaging in this current rule set compared to the past.
Yeah, I think the one thing we've got to keep in mind here is that Nico Rosberg was a very competent racing driver, but as far as a racing car designer is concerned, I think he sort of lacked a little bit of knowledge about that. And you're right. I mean, the end plates, to be honest, in the configuration they are on an F1 car is there because the regulations dictate you have to have it. An actual fact, you know, other than not quite knowing what it's done to the flow structure around the side of the car, I would have said losing the front wing end plate was actually beneficial. Potentially beneficial is the best way of putting it, because the outwash would be much more around that front tyre. It's there to reduce the outwash, which was considered to be one of the things that was affecting cars in traffic, because obviously if the air spills around the outside of the car, it affects any car that's behind you more than if it's going through between the wheels of the car. So it's one of those sort of situations where it's probably not optimised to be a benefit, but at the end of the day, I think it's a very small loss, if anything, and I would say it's more or less unnoticeable for the driver. So, a little bit of Nico saying what he needed to say at the time, I suppose. Definitely not tenths of a second. If there was a loss, it would be hundreds. And if there was a gain, it would be hundreds. So I'd say not relevant, to be honest.
The next question comes from Mauricio Guerrero from Brazil, who says, as you've mentioned that there's no such thing as a dumb question, here comes one. We know that ride height is a crucial parameter to the setup of these so-called ground effect cars of the current F1 regulations. As I understand it, you want to run these cars as close to the ground as possible in order to achieve maximum aero performance, albeit avoiding too low a ride height and avoid triggering bouncing and porpoising. My question related to that regards the variable weight of the cars during a race stint. As the cars start the race with maximum weight due to fuel load, can we assume that the lower ride height that these cars run is during the start of the race, and therefore the aero efficiency progressively decreases throughout the race? If so, does it also mean that during qualifying, when the cars are running on the sniff of an oily rag, they are actually under a suboptimal aero performance? Or are there any tricks in the suspension with which to compensate such variability in car weight throughout the race?
Well, it's never a dumb question, as we say, and it's a very good question, Maurizio. It's one of these things, you know, if we do look at the cars, for example, you know, they do produce something in the region, at high speed, they do produce something in the region of 4 tons of downforce, 4,000 kilograms. And the car itself weighs 790. So, you know, at the end of a long straight there, the car is going to be sort of almost 5 ton in downforce. And we're talking here for a fuel load of 100 kilograms or 105 maybe, but a difference to qualifying of 100 kilograms. So the weight of the car because of the fuel is a relatively small percentage. It won't be as though the car is less than optimum in qualifying and at the best at the start of the race, because obviously the difference is the fact that 100 kilograms, you've got to accelerate and brake it as well. So it's one of those things that, you know, it all gets washed out, really, in the whole thing. If you did optimise the ride height of the car to suit the low fuel, and it did mean that it was too low at high speed, obviously the plank wear would be higher, and could run you into trouble with scrutineer and post-race. But the difference would be very, very small. The difference in ride height, you'd be talking tenths of a millimetre. And I think that would just wash out really in the overall performance and the overall downforce that the car can generate. The big thing, to be honest, is that to try to make it that the car design and the airflow structure is such that it's not, you're not really using the mechanical seal of getting the car near the ground. You're using that aerodynamic seal. And I often say, you know, having an aerodynamic seal down the side of the floor, it's a bit more like a dimmer switch than an on-off switch. So that little bit of ride height change, that tenth of a millimetre or, you know, half a millimetre, is not quite as critical. The losses won't be as big and the gains won't be as big, but the consistency will be much, much better.
And obviously, teams will have a good understanding of any slight variations, but there is the interesting question, because it's not just that. You've obviously got the fuel loads shifting as well, where the fuel is in the car. Obviously, there's a lot of effort that goes into managing the fuel in the fuel tanks and that kind of thing. So I guess there are little details in terms of the performance of the car over a race duration that teams will try and understand. But like you say, there's so many different variables that interact. It potentially becomes one of those things that becomes too difficult to play tunes on, as it were, and you're just having to come up with kind of the best place for the car that works for everything, and there's no sneaky tricks to gain in certain conditions.
Yeah, it is an overall performance, a weekend performance window you're looking at, really, and, you know, especially qualifying in the race. You're looking at being able to do one lap, get the tyre temperatures up there, working well, and the ride height, as you say, the optimum, or very, very close to the optimum. But you also need to accommodate the fact that you're going to do a 50 or 60 lap race with a higher fuel load. So, you know, the optimum isn't always just the best for one situation. We've often seen in the past where we felt that there was teams that weren't as good in qualifying as they were in the race, and vice versa. You know, I think if we take Haas last year, it had a big problem in the race. Hülkenberg was very good at qualifying well, but just went backwards like a stone being dropped come the race. Whereas this year they're in a bit better position. They're actually still look as though they're able to reasonably hang on to the qualifying position. Maybe not quite as good as last year, but they're definitely more consistent in the race. So that's just the compromise between those two disciplines. And you need, you know, the weekend is not just about one thing, it's about the whole thing. So you need to just get that compromise right. And if you do that, you know, then that's the objective of the weekend.
Next up, we've got a question from Jay Menon, who says, in the latest Beyond the Grid podcast, Haas team principal Ayo Komatsu briefly talked about his experience of tyre testing with Fernando Alonso during the tyre war years. He talks of how Alonso could drive the tyres in a certain way at the start of a stint to ensure that he could achieve a target lap time at the end of the stint. Komatsu also stated how Alonso would always maximise his tyre usage to extract peak performance in every stint. A driver capable of this is certainly very valuable during a race, as it would make the strategist's life much easier. How relevant are these skills in today's tyre formula? With the way tyres are these days, can it even be managed in the way the Michelins behaved in the tyre war era? And lastly, who do you think has the best handle of tyres on the current grid?
Very difficult question to answer. First thing is, just taking Alonso into account, I think they did, between them and him and the team this weekend, going to that soft tyre with whatever 30 laps to go or something in the race, I think showed that they were lacking a little bit of information as to what they should do. You know, they had a set of mediums and they had a set of softs. If I'd been on the pit wall, I'd have been putting the mediums on with 30 laps to go, because there was a good chance you could actually finish the race. And if not, you'd have had, if there's a safety car or something late in the race, you would have had a set of softs to put on for that last 10 or 12 laps. So you could get the best out of both. But putting the softs on with 30 laps to go, there was no way you're going to make the end of the race. So you're going to have to do another pit stop. So, you know, it's always relevant to the situation at that point in time. I think whenever you're talking about Michelin tyres and Alonso optimising and using them, that was all relevant to the Michelin tyres. The Pirelli tyres that are currently used in Formula 1 now are a very, very different beast. So I don't think the information from those days would really be a big advantage. Alonso used to use the car at the beginning of a stint, and we saw it many, many times with the Michelin tyres where he would oversteer the car, in other words, put too much steering lock on the car and go past the the slip angle of the front tire, just to make sure that he was having the balance at the beginning of it whenever the front tire was too good for the rear. So he would create understeer himself in a way. And then as the tire balance would change, he would reduce that oversteering on the front tire. So the tires would, it always worked with the rear tire, basically. He'd always try to make sure that the rear tire was at its optimum. I don't think you can do that with these tires. The slip angle on these tires is much smaller than they were on the Michelin tire. So it's one of these sort of things where I think you have to work with the tires you've got. I don't think it would have been a big help for him for these days. You've got a different tire, you've got to understand it a little bit differently. As far as anybody on the grid can handle the tires, I think, Lando Norris isn't bad in China. He looked after the tires very well. It's one of those things, when the car balance is good, you've always got a driver that can look after the tires. Sergio Perez, with his years at Racing Point, he was looked after as the sort of tire whisperer. So it's the situation with the car you've got as opposed to the driver. You have to say that Max Verstappen isn't too bad looking after tires. He's won enough races just to show that he's able to read the tire quite well and work within its capabilities, and usually go as long as anybody competitively on a tire. So I don't think there's any one driver out there that can take a not-so-good car or a car that isn't as well balanced and sort of use his talent to look after the tire better. I think it's a combination of the driver and the car and the way you want the balance of the car. So I think the question's out as to who, as a team, gets the car balanced best to look after the tires, and the driver then drives within the tires, driving that car that's being kind to the tires.
There's also the situational element, isn't there, that if you're, say, a team slap bang in the midfield of F1, for the sake of arguments, it's a little bit harder to manage the tyres in races simply because you can't play it the way you want to. You referred to Verstappen in the sprint race earlier. He could bring the tyres in nicely early on and then deploy the speed when he needed it. Whereas if you're trying to pull off an undercut or you're under attack or whatever right at the start of your stint, sometimes you're forced to pushing hard on the fresh tyre when there's the most rubber on it, where there's the most movement. You can obviously very much define the life of the tyre, certainly the kind of performance you get out of it with the way you treat it early on. And sometimes you can end up with cars that look like they treat tyres particularly badly, but sometimes it can just be situational. So it illustrates that virtuous circle, doesn't it? That when you're at the front, you've probably got a car that's well balanced and can treat the tyres well, but you also have the greater opportunity sometimes. So it's another one of those ones that shows the complexity of this whole equation.
Yeah, it is, for sure. I mean, the one thing, by definition, if you're mid-pack, you're mid-pack. You're in traffic, you're going to be in more turbulence than the guy out front. So immediately, your tyres are going to get a harder time. You know, we talk about these cars have been better in traffic than the older generation cars were pre-2022. But it's only relative. There's still a downforce loss, and there is a front downforce loss when you're in traffic. So that will always compromise your balance, which is when you start to hurt the tyre. I mean, if a car's understeering, you think, okay, I'm destroying the front tyre, but that's not true. A car that understeers will have much more snappy oversteer and corner exit. So that it's very difficult to look after the rear tyres. No matter what the situation is, it's difficult to look after the rear tyre. That's the one you've got to watch, because that's the one that, drives you forward all the time. And also it's a tyre that gives you the balance front to rear. If you have a little bit of understeer, say it's driver confidence inspiring, I suppose you might call it, but you've got to be careful that you're careful on that throttle. And we see it quite often. You see a bit of understeer in the car and then a snap oversteer, and that's what happens, because as you reduce the steering lock on corner exit, you go back to where the tire's gripping best, the front tire, and the front tire will grip, and you just can't react fast enough. The front tire will grip quicker than you can sort of steady the throttle or back off the throttle a little bit. So you always get that snap because, the front tire's gripped, giving you more cornering power, and the rear is just at the same position, so it will slide more. So, yeah, it's always a compromise. The best place to be is on pole position, disappear, get a second at least a second of a lead by the end of the first lap, and you're out of DRS, day done, you know, that's it. You need a fast car to win races, that's what you need. Nothing else matters, to be honest.
Exactly. Speed makes things a lot easier when it comes to racing, certainly. The next question comes from Eric Knecht, who says, as an American newbie to the sport of only about the last five seasons or so, how do teams determine what direction their car philosophy goes in? Do they look at engine power compared to the others? Do they have a sort of historical precedent they need to follow with previous generations of cars? I've always found it fascinating to learn what exactly makes every team's car tick, and there don't seem to be very many resources online for this question to be answered easily. Examples I'm referring to are McLaren's last couple of cars being famously difficult to handle under braking and in slow corners, while being an absolute monster in high speed corners, while the Williams of last year and the year before had a top speed that rivaled even Ferrari while being a battleship in the turns.
Yeah, I mean, that is the one thing, one question, Eric, in my mind that separates a lot of the teams is the fact of their overall car characteristic philosophy, I suppose you might call it. Now, if we take a couple of examples here, you know, McLaren, they probably have a car that aerodynamically is very stable in the fast corners. That normally will come from the fact that it doesn't actually produce the same levels of ride height at lower speed. And when I say lower speed, I mean higher ride height, because obviously the two go hand in hand. The car's higher when it's going slow than it is when it's going fast. If you have a car that produces lots of downforce when you've got high ride height because the underfloor is very aggressive, I suppose you might call it, then you run into airflow separation problems when it gets to a lower ride height. So it's a sort of chicken and egg situation. You've got to make that philosophy of your car needs to be for the big operating window that it goes through. You know, we get corners that are low speed corners that are, let's say, 100 k's or even slower 80 k's, and you're in the middle of those corners for seconds. If you get a high speed corner that's 320-330 kilometers an hour, you're in those corners for tenths of a second. So there is more gain in low speed corners than there is in high speed corners, but the driver needs a car that's balanced in high speed corners just to be able to do the corner at that speed. So, yeah, McLaren's deficit could be the fact that it's not got the downforce number of the car's high. They run the front of the car maybe a bit stiffer than their philosophy of front-to-rear suspension rate. If you run the front a bit stiffer, it will be a bit more of a handful in low-speed corners, but it'll be more stable in high-speed corners. So, again, that's the setup philosophy. And your aerodynamic development is done via your setup philosophy. You know, that you go through a ride height range in the wind tunnel, and that ride height range is defined by the stiffness of the car. So as your ride heights change by going faster, you know, the car will move relative to the front and rear stiffness, vertical stiffness that you've got the car. And that's, you've got to take that all into account, because your wind tunnel, none of it's done transiently. It's all done at steady state. So it's all done at different ride heights. And that front to rear relationship is relative to the stiffness of the front and rear suspension. So you've got to be careful that you're not sort of tricking yourself and thinking, well, look at that, I can produce much, much more downforce, low ride height, but very little downforce at high ride height. So I need to run the car lower. If I run the car lower, I need to run the car stiffer. So you end up with a spiral to nowhere, because you end up with the car solid and a fixed ride height as such. And, you know, you can't drive it like that. So it's your sort of internal company philosophy that allows you to sort of put together a package that means you end up with good downforce at high speed, good downforce at low speed, and a compliant car when it comes to hitting curbs. Going on to the Williams situation, yes. You know, we saw, I think, the last couple of years, Williams had a car that was very fast in the straight, but it lacked cornering ability. But their compromise was pretty decent. I think their compromise was for the level they are, the knowledge that they've got, wasn't a bad place to be, because the more you try to make the car go around corners fast, the better the car has to be, aerodynamic stability. Going down straight quickly, we could all do that. I've never heard a driver complaining about the car understeering or oversteering down the straight. Whereas once you get into a corner, the balance of the car matters, the consistency of the downforce matters. All that stuff really becomes a problem. Whereas going down the straight, 5 kilometres, 10 kilometres quicker than anybody else, the balance doesn't really matter too much. So by making the car go around corners faster with more downforce, you go a little bit slower in the straight because of the drag, but the problems become a multitude more because just the fact of keeping the balance consistent. So you can easily dig a hole for yourself. It's about the knowledge you have within the team, I suppose, and how you optimise your car. But it's the philosophy of how the car works aerodynamically. And that's never changed for many, many years. It's still the same thing. As a human being turning the steering wheel, and he needs confidence in the car from low speed to high speed and consistency. And that's what the philosophy of a team should be. Give the driver that confidence.
Well, we'll have a few more questions in a moment, but just a reminder that if you wanted to send in any questions for future episodes, send them to podcasts@therace.com. That's podcasts@the-race.com. You can either send them in written form, or you can send a voice note if you record that on your phone and attach that to the email, letting us know who you are in it, and we'll play that in the show. Right, on to a second batch of questions now, Gary. You've had your warm-up questions. You've got plenty in you in terms of answers, I hope. The next question comes from Javier Sanchez, who says, Williams have talked about making their car a better all-round package, so less strong in a straight line, but in doing so have seemingly made it harder to score points, given they can't hang on in front of faster cars, as Alex Albon made his trademark in recent years. Is this a convenient excuse for a worse car, or is there something to it?
I think it is a convenient excuse, to be honest. The car itself isn't a better package. You know, the package is the compromise between straight line speed and cornering ability. And if you're going to give one up, you have to make sure you gain in the other one. And my answer to that question would be the fact that, you know, a straight line isn't really too big a drama. You can hold off faster cars. Because you know if they can't get past you on the straight, the likelihood of them passing you in a corner is pretty low, because that's not what racing's about these days. Racing's about doing the best you can and then being in the right position with the DRS down the straights. So that's when overtaking takes place. So Williams in the past had a good philosophy of just generating enough downforce to be a reasonable car and making sure the car was balanced to their straight line speed. And if the car was balanced through the corners, they weren't really hurting the tyres too much. The car might be moving a little bit more, but if it's got a decent balance, the driver will live with that as long as he knows where he needs to be quick. That last corner onto the straight, try and do the best you can. And normally the corners onto the straight these days in these type of circuits is a lower speed corner. So downforce is not such a massive thing. But once you give up that straight line speed, you're sitting duck. And if you've got a slower car that's going slower down the straight or the same speed as somebody else and somebody else got DRS, then you're sitting duck. And that's what Williams are suffering from this year. They're basically giving up their benefit and not really got the advantage.
To play devil's advocate on that, can you argue you sometimes need to take one step back to go two steps forward? Because obviously downforce is the name of the game, isn't it? So sometimes you can have a car that's overpowered in certain areas, and if you can get a little bit higher than maybe would be your natural level, you can sit there. Whereas you need to kind of push through that in order to get into that sequence of just adding performance. So I think that's the kind of argument Williams is trying to make, that their car is a bit better, but actually it's a little bit harder to get those bigger results. But they might end up, rather than fluctuating between, I'd say, 6th fastest and 10th fastest, they're a bit more consistently, say, 8th fastest, 7th fastest, but without that peakiness. Do you think there's anything in that, or do you still think that's filed under just excuses?
I would file that under just excuses, to be honest, Ed. It's one of these sort of philosophies. I haven't seen the benefit, and I haven't heard the drivers talk about the benefit. It's only, it's early this year. We've got a few races to go yet with this 24-race season, so maybe they will find their feet. They've had a pretty rough start to the season because of accidents and incidents, but those accidents and incidents didn't happen for no reason. They happened for some reason. There was obviously a few that were not necessarily their driver's fault, but there was a few that were their driver's fault. And those usually come from the fact that the car is not as consistent. The thing about a car that's got a bit less grip is, a bit less grip but still well balanced, will be that the driver will drive it quickly, as quick as it can go, because the car will just move that little bit more, slide that little bit more. But it won't be nasty to drive. And what I'm seeing at the minute, I think, is a car that is a bit nastier to drive. As you say, time will maybe fix it. And that's why I say there's quite a few races to go this season yet. And you've got to give them a chance to catch up just with bits, never mind the fact of development bits. So all's not lost yet with Williams. But as I say, you've got to sort of see where the gain comes from before you throw the baby out with the bathwater. If you keep the straight line speed and gain on downforce, then that's the objective. But you don't want to just give away the straight line speed and not actually get the consistent downforce. But as you say, time will tell whether they actually have made the right decisions. At the minute, I'm not seeing it.
The next question comes from Robin McPhee, who says, in 2020, McLaren trialled driver seats manufactured from natural flax fibre as a sustainable alternative to traditional carbon fibre composites. McLaren highlighted flax fibre's many advantages over carbon fibre, not just environmental, such as up to 30% reduction of raw material costs, resistance to brittle fracturing and splintering, and its greater vibration absorption. McLaren gave the impression that flax fibre is a better performing material than traditional carbon fibre in some use cases. However, since then, I've not heard of McLaren or any other team adopting flax fibre in the manufacturing of their cars. Was this material ultimately deemed unsuitable for F1, or is it being used in areas not immediately visible to fans?
Well, on the latter part there, yeah. Areas not visible to fans. I mean, they may use it for the seats in the car. We don't know. I wouldn't be surprised. But the one thing as a team I don't think I've ever done or saw another team doing is, if they find something that's better, and better's a very loose word here, if they find something that's better, you don't stand up and publicly shout about it. You get on with using it until somebody finds out you're using it. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's some usage going on with different materials from what we classify as the very loose word carbon fibre, because carbon fibre's endless. It goes from one end of the scale to the other, as far as strength's concerned, right through to stiffness. So you don't get nothing for nothing in this world. As I say, carbon fibre, you can start with a fibre that's very tough, but it's not very stiff, and you can go right through to a fibre that's hugely, hugely stiff, but, if you look at a little crack. So it's one of those sort of situations where you've got to choose the material for the right application. I go back from the days of the seat being a foam insert that you made and the driver sat in it, it's an area where you can experiment. But as I say, that for the same stiffness on a component, you either, if it's cheaper, you usually have to put more weight into it, and if it's more exotic, you can have a lighter component. So I'm not saying McLaren aren't using the material, and I'm not saying it isn't environmentally the right thing to do. But it's courses for courses. You need to make sure you're using it in the right application. And as I say, we haven't heard that much about it. I wouldn't be surprised if they use it for those seats or for some other bits and pieces that aren't critical to the stiffness or the weight of the car. The driver's seat's a typical example, because the driver and seat are weighed together. And I think it's 85 kilograms perhaps that they have to be. Otherwise, you've got a bit of ballast into it. So that ballast, you might as well make the seat heavier if you've got lighter drivers, because it means that the seat is it spreads that the weight all around the seat area and the driver area, as opposed to one having to bolt some ballast in one position. But you have an opportunity to use a different material that isn't as stiff for a given weight. And if you've got some other material that saves you, that will save the world or save you some money, then you might as well use it for the seat. So I wouldn't be surprised if they still use it for that, but I haven't seen details of it.
Yeah, there's certainly references to it still being in the seat last year, so I suspect they probably are. But yeah, as you say, it's not necessarily going to be changing the world, and if it was, they'd probably not shout about it too loudly. Next question comes from Oliver Dale, who says, I'd love to know more about how an F1 car livery and paint is applied and how long this takes, etc. What sort of paints are the heaviest, new and old? Metallic colours, like a gold Jordan or metallic green Jaguar? Why have a gloss matte paint? How has the significance of a car livery in motorsport evolved over time? The most recent evolution on a car I see is the McLaren e-ink screens either side of the driver that changes through the race, which points to a strange possible future. One could argue today an F1 car livery has the least significance it's ever had, given teams are stripping them back further and further to just a carbon car. Is there a future where that could happen? A rich billionaire who doesn't want a livery. Also, has the Ferrari red got lighter over the years? Well, there's lots of paint-related questions there, Gary. Obviously, you've got some experience with that. It's one of those, I guess, peripheral things that if you're a technical director, you're aware of. So what can you tell us?
Well, if you go way back to... as you say, the Jordan, the gold Jordan, or the metallic green Jaguar. When those cars were being built, they were, whenever they hit the ground, they were in the rough region of 50 kilograms under the weight limit, because everybody was pushing the fact that you couldn't put ballast load down in the car, lower the center of gravity of the car because of that. So you built the car as light as you could, it wasn't a problem. So the paint, the paint didn't matter. So your metallic paint or whatever could add a bit of weight to the car because you had a window to play with the ballast underneath the car. And I suppose you might say that back then, looks were important. That has sort of negated itself through time. People tried to find different solutions with paintwork to generate small vortices to break up the boundary layer. All sorts of stuff, but it's really, really difficult to do that consistently. So I think most teams have sort of like given up a little bit now. And it's a big compromise currently between the amount of resin that's left in the carbon fiber. Because whenever you're baking the carbon fiber, it's put under pressure and you have a bleed cloth. So you're actually theoretically squeezing the resin, which is bonding the carbon fiber together. You're squeezing a percentage of that resin out of the carbon fiber and you're bleeding it into this bleed cloth. So you end up, you start with whatever 40% resin, you end up with maybe 20% resin or something. So the more you do that, though, then the rougher, I suppose you might call it, the carbon fiber surface will be. But that's lighter than paint. So it's the compromise between getting that rough carbon fiber surface to look good by, I suppose you might call it filler paint, and then putting the colour paint on top of that. And that's what's led a little bit to the teams using a matte finish, because on a rougher carbon surface, the matte finish doesn't look bad. On a rough carbon surface, a gloss finish would look terrible. So, it's a compromise again of the resin left in the carbon and the finish of the carbon compared to the finish of the paint that you want. And that'll always be a compromise. And currently, with the weight limit the way it is, teams are pushing hard to achieve that weight limit. There is so much stuff on these cars now, stuff that makes them work, that it's gone are the days of building a car 50 kilograms under the weight limit. You're lucky if you can build a car that's on the weight limit. As I say, because there's so much stuff on them. And then that means, the teams will compromise on how much you paint it. I mean, paint's still the same thing. It's put in a spray gun and it's sprayed across the surface. And depending upon the surface you want, that's what you get. The surface that you can live with, that's what you get. So, yeah, if you had a rich billionaire coming in and saying, I'm happy, I like a black car, then we can have a black car. You don't have to paint it at all. Just some decals on it will break it up quite nicely. And, as I say, when we released the Jordan 191 initially in carbon fibre, it was one of the nicest looking carbon fibre cars I've ever seen. I'm a bit biased there because obviously it was my responsibility, but the design of it was my responsibility. But at the end of the day, I don't think it looked bad because it was black. And at that point in time, we weren't getting tricked with resin content and stuff like that. We weren't clever enough to do all that. But it was one of those sort of situations where it looked okay in black, so I wouldn't be against a black car, and I don't think it's wrong. I don't think the cars look bad at the moment at all. You know, they're 50-50 on paint scheme, and they use the black, you know, part of the car as part of the colour scheme. So nothing wrong with what we've got, but paint will add weight.
If you'd like to hear a little bit more about that, we did do an episode on how paint shapes performance in October 2022, when we also spoke to Mark Turner from Silverstone Paint Technology and Seamless Digital. And Seamless Digital is the company that does those dynamic panels on the McLaren. So you can find out a little bit more there. As I say, if you want to send in a question, send it to podcasts@therace.com, podcasts@the-race.com, either written or voice note form. And as one of our questioners alluded to, yeah, there are no stupid questions. The more questions, the better, ultimately. And there's an infinite amount of technical topics in F1 for us to dive into. So, yeah, fire them through and we will endeavour to answer them. Well, we're going to be back after the Miami Grand Prix, so stay with us for more from Gary.
The Athletic.